Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour once again on January 5th, 2015. That's today's date, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. I hope you all had some rest and relaxation over the Christmas New Year holiday and recharged your batteries, as I did. So because of that, I've got a big program tonight with lots of important things to say. I really do think they're important. And I'm starting, therefore, the new year out with what might become some, at least one major theme for the coming year. So first, though, I want to thank some contributors for their kind and generous donations. Since the last time I mentioned contributions, I have Lawana in Florida, Jim in Arizona, Dimitar in Ontario, Dan in California, and John in London. I thank each and every one of you very much. And I got some nice Christmas greetings and cards, too, from them and from others. And just today, an anonymous friend from the Los Angeles area, at least he sent me a newspaper section from the LA Times, but it's from back a few years ago. In any case, though, I'll talk more about that on Thursday's Table Talk with Ray Goodwin, because of what he said, I know that Ray will get a kick out of it, as I did, and you listeners probably will too. Now, I could name tonight's program Ignorance is the Greatest Sin, but it's not a very charismatic title, and it doesn't carry the topic of the content of the program very well. I still haven't come up with the right title for tonight. I hope I do before I make up the post after the show's over, but I believe that it's true that the greatest sin is ignorance. It does more harm than anything else, and so I'm going to do my part in dissipating some ignorance right now. Over the past few weeks, I was enjoying reading health information and news that applies to me and my particular situation. And the most important thing I read, in my opinion, this is because spoke to me the most clearly, was a page titled The Lost History of Medicine. But it wasn't until 2 days ago that the connection between that and what I was reading about the prince and the sex slave, etc., and the madam and so on, jumped into my head. The subject of the medical page is the terrain is everything. The germ is nothing. This may be familiar to some of you because there is a truth in medicine or health that an unhealthy, out-of-balance body makes disease possible. The inner environment, down to the cellular level, is what's called the terrain, or what's meant by the terrain. Louis Pasteur is considered, in fact, I had, this was not brand new to me, but I had kind of forgotten all about it, or just wasn't thinking about it, and I was glad to be reminded of it. And so I'll go on to give you a little bit about the idea of the terrain and the importance of a healthy terrain. Louis Pasteur is considered the father of the germ theory of medicine, and he invented the process of pasteurization, so it's said. Well, not really. It was 100 years older than Pasteur, but he got credit for it, which reflects the way things are done for mysterious reasons in our social order. Much of Pasteur's work was very unscientific, and his counterparts believed that many of his counterparts, who found his work not very scientific, believed that the terrain was more important than the germ. The terrain does not mean the immune system. The immune system is separate from that. A healthy terrain is simply an alkaline pH in your body. You get an alkaline pH by eating alkaline foods or raw foods, or both. Pasteur proved his germ theory by injecting healthy animals with the blood of a sick animal. And the author said that we do not catch germs in this fashion. I mean, if I had to get an injection to catch a cold, I'd never catch one. We're not injected with unhealthy tissue or germs or whatever. It just happens that we feel we have this idea in our medical belief system that somehow we get invaded by these bad things, and that infects our body. We have to get rid of these bad things in order to become healthy again. That's the basic philosophy of the kind of medicine that Louis Pasteur was a part of. And the fact that was brought out also in this, which I'll just mention very briefly, the fact was brought out that this style of medical belief and physical reality belief is makes more money for the system than the terrain system. I mean, there's more money, there's more profit that can be made from medical practice healing this way, from the germ theory of medicine, than there is from the terrain theory. Rudolf Virchow, who's known as the father of pathology, wrote this as he was an old man, I guess. If I could live my life over again, I would devote it to proving that germs seek their natural habitat, disease, which is diseased tissue, rather than being the cause of the diseased tissue. For example, mosquitoes seek the stagnant water, but do not cause the pool to become stagnant. The proper terrain alone was by itself enough for perfect health, in this view, nor had it ever occurred to me, the author said, that the immune system was merely a backup system that took over when the terrain failed. But that, in fact, is the case, according to this view of things, that the immune system, in a healthy terrain, the immune system is not even necessary because there's nothing unhealthy that's attracted to it and nothing to disturb it. But if such would happen, then the immune system is there. You see the wisdom of our wonderful, wonderful bodies, just amazing what they do for us, how hard our bodies are working all the time. But if something does get into our terrain, well, our immune system is there to come up and do something about it, and so it's like a backup system. Now, again, what is a healthy terrain? First, it's one with alkalinity, which and pH above 7 is an alkaline terrain, and below 7 is acidic. And of course, the further, let's say, if you had a pH of 1 or 2, that's highly, highly acidic. Pure water has a pH of around 7. That's the dividing line between the dividing number between acid and alkaline. And the second thing that a healthy terrain has is a negative electrical charge. Physically, one must have proper nutrition and be free of toxins to maintain a healthy terrain. Emotionally, also, one must have healthy thoughts to maintain mental health. Alkalinity creates an oxygen-rich environment, and bacteria, yeast, cancer, and viruses, just to name a few, survive without oxygen. They are said to have an anaerobic, without oxygen, existence. They metabolize without oxygen, just like fermentation. Likewise, they cannot exist in an oxygen-rich environment. Think about that. They cannot exist where oxygen is present in enough amounts. So they appear in acidic environments, and the more acidic the better, and disappear in alkaline environments. This is nature, friends. You know, in National Socialism, we talk of following natural law. Well, this is a part of it, and we can't ignore it. This is natural law. So now, do you see the parallel with our Jewish problem? The germ in our inner terrain is the Jew in our social terrain. In exactly the same way, the Jewish toxic influence could not survive in a healthy social environment. How to create that healthy social environment is really our task. First, we must get rid of organized Jewish influence as much as possible, as was the goal in the Third Reich. Jews are continually injecting their toxic ideas and thought into the social environment. They have to be removed, but more, their culture, the culture that they've set in motion, also has to be removed. But I realize what I'm saying here, that none of this is immediately possible. This is a huge, huge reality that we have allowed to grow since for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Because just think, I was thinking how this goes back to Abraham and Sarah and the Egyptians, all the way back to Egypt, when Abraham, I'm a little ahead of myself probably, but thinking about the sex slave scandal, which I'm going to be talking about, back all the way then, in the year, what was it, 5, 6,000 B.C., something like that, supposedly. Abraham pimped his wife, Sarah, to the Pharaoh of Egypt. I don't believe this story, but anyway, the story is there as something good that he did, you know. Went in order to gain favors from Pharaoh for himself and his supposedly his tribe. And when Pharaoh recognized that she was his wife and not his sister, as he had said, he became enraged and felt he had done a terrible thing. It offended his morality. And he accused Abraham, and he was so horrified by the whole thing, he just wanted him to leave his kingdom. And he gave them all the help they needed or required to have them leave. And they took a lot of goods with them because he just didn't want people like that around. He recognized how damaging they were in the sense of what I've just been talking about. We don't recognize that anymore. Some of us think we do, but we still don't understand that we are addicted to so much that has been added to our environment that we're so used to it that we don't know how to do without it. But in any case, as I said, since none of this is immediately possible, the next best thing is to make sure we have an alkaline, or that's in quotes, a non-acidic, meaning non-Jewish, personal environment. That really does require quite a bit in itself, but it doesn't require trying to take care of the whole society. So each person, the only way to start is for each person to begin in their own life. This really does require giving up all toxic substances over which the individual has control. As I said, did I already say or didn't I? The most acidic product we consume is alcohol. Think about that. And that brings up that I posted the alcohol map, alcohol consumption world map at carolynyager.net last night. Because when I saw it, I thought, well, this relates to what I'm going to be talking about tonight, and it's important. It doesn't exactly relate because it says where the most alcohol consumption takes place. I didn't post it there because, as people like to accuse me, that I hate Russians and I hate Slavs, but it does show that they have the biggest alcohol consumption in the world. And the more alcohol consumed, you know, the alcohol consumption in Russia, and so probably in Ukraine also, is terribly damaging to that country. And that country is not, the people in that country are not very productive, and they're accident prone, and there's a lot of times we hear of bus crashes, plane crashes, train crashes, and it turns out the person who was supposed to be watching over this was drinking and was not paying attention. This happens a lot there because there is a tremendous amount of alcohol consumption in that country, and it does a lot of damage. But going on to this subject, As we have to give up harmful foods and drink for if we're seeking physical health, and we really do, you know, your youth can override and your immune system can override a whole lot of things that you're doing. But it comes a time when you know, as you age, your everything gets weaker, and your immune system is not able to keep up with that, and little by little. There's a lot of strain on your system, on certain glands that are necessary. I don't know if you call them glands, organs, so on, that are putting out necessary hormones and even sending messages to your brain and getting in your brain connections taking place properly. All of this gets weaker and weaker, and it's all because you have allowed your terrain to become polluted. Even if you've tried not to, you know, if you've lasted longer than other people and you've done better than other people, it still will happen if you don't have a perfectly healthy terrain. So it means that giving up all of this stuff, you know. And in our social environment, it means giving up Jew-created culture, such as just the main things that you'd start with, television, movies. Lots of internet sites that you might be addicted to, and I don't mean just porn sites. Just there's a lot of others that aren't doing you any good, or me, or any of us, and also friends who are not on board with this, and so on and on. But those are things that are in the control of an individual. The things in our social order, on a wider basis, we can't just fix and do away with. We can only do something about what we're allowing ourselves to participate in. Now, I want to mention that if this sounds too impossible or too boring, then we need to realize that we are a polluted white person who is only talking about helping or loving our people and being against the Jew. Because if we're not doing what I've just said, then we're not doing what we can. We're not really fighting against a Jew. We've become too weakened, and we're actually a harmful element, and the first thing we need to do is to heal and strengthen ourselves. So, again, the greatest sin is ignorance. It does the most damage. Our medical and scientific communities have sold out to the profiteers and have erased one huge chunk of science, which is called scientific fact, from our history. You stay sick. We all say stay sick, and they stay rich. Of course, I don't go to doctors hardly. Just a few on a rare occasion. But I'm not a part of that operation. But I'm not totally okay either because I'm not strict enough, although I'm darn strict. So a lot of people couldn't do what I'm doing. But, you know, the more you do it, it gets easier. The more you give up, it gets easier. You lose your sense of needing it. But age plays a role too. Similarly, our indigenous white European societies have sold out to the Jews, led by our elites who actually continue to gain from it. So first they sold us out, and then they just keep selling out the whole society and erased huge chunks of historical fact from our history. Now that gets into an area that I'm very interested in. That's one way we've been sold out. We continue to believe lies and guilt about ourselves, and they stay rich. So I'm talking about our white elites who are gaining from all this and who are happy to cooperate with the Jews and with allowing our society to become Judaized. Now, if you think that from this, that since you're of the opinion you don't believe the lies, you had better examine yourself more closely, because there's a lot of lies that we don't even recognize, or you might not even recognize as a lie. There's a lot of stories that come out that in the news, and we all start reacting to it in the usual way. It's kind of a it's known how we're going to react to it. And when we see a lot of the reaction to any new kind of scandal, that we can point the finger and say, that's the Jews who are doing that, and we start trying to expose it all, we're actually not getting anywhere, because we've been doing this for a long, long time, and it's not changing anything. In fact, we keep getting weaker. People who are saying today that we're getting stronger, well, I don't see it in actual power base, in the actual power that people have. I think that this terrain philosophy is the right way to go, is the stronger way to go. And so I'll fit that in a little bit more as we go along. I want to ask, say something about why 14 to 17-year-old girls are highly vulnerable to the advances of older, powerful men. You know, this story that has come out with Jane Doe number 3, who we now know is Virginia Roberts, I think it's Roberts, and more has been revealed about this lawsuit, and good for her for having the guts to do this. She seems to be quite determined about it, realizing that it's really up to her and others like her to speak out for anything like this to be exposed properly. You might say that, well, these girls went into this voluntarily. You know, young women of this age are sexy, even though they're considered to be underage. They're really not. A lot of men think that they shouldn't be considered underage because they just use their sexual wiles and so on to take advantage of the men, and then the men are in trouble legally for it, blah, blah, and they're dangerous, these girls, because they're sexually developed, but mentally they're not mature enough, and that's very true. But in my experience, girls like this, particularly if they're attractive and men like them, are very vulnerable to advances of these older, powerful men. It might not be that powerful, but it would seem to be to a young girl or to a young woman. And they actually do believe, I think, they actually believe that they're attracted to this man, that they enjoy the attention, that there's something good that's going to come from it, that they actually can very easily believe that these men sincerely like them and care about them and are going to help them and look after them and so on. They don't have any trouble falling into that belief and then feeling that they need to stay with this person, and they need to do what he says, and they don't want to lose his approval in his company and then the other benefits that they get. It doesn't take long for a young girl to fall into this state of mind, unless she's from a very tight family, been brought up very carefully, or maybe in the church and has strong religious views. Then it would not be very possible. But girls who are a little bit looking for, you know, for something out of the average and are bored with their life and so on, are very vulnerable to all of this. So I don't blame the girls. I would never blame the girl. Now, before I go on, the woman who's involved in this Ghislaine Maxwell, who is the daughter of Robert Maxwell. I wanted to talk about him a little bit because, you know, this is just so typical of what happens. So I don't know if I'm just assuming that everybody knows this story and has been reading about it. But it's the thing. Let me just say this first. A lot of people are taking the attitude toward this that it's about the Jews. And I started out with the Jews, but I'm really talking about our social terrain that we live in, and our, and of course our individual health terrain also, our individual physical body terrain, but seeing the Jew as the germ. How does, you know, how we keep our environment, how we keep our terrain going is our business and is our responsibility. And nobody can take that, those choices away from us unless we just give them up. So what I take from this whole story is not to say, oh, look at, here's Alan, is his name Alan Dershowitz, and this Jeffrey Epstein, and this Ghislaine Maxwell, and they're all Jews, and there's other Jews involved, and they've all in this sex club thing and taking advantage of underage girls. And this is another opportunity to show what's wrong with Jews and how rotten Jews are and so on. I'm taking a different approach to this, and I'm looking at Prince Andrew. And, you know, Prince Andrew has been made out to be a victim. In some sense, he's already been being seen as a victim of these of people who are blackmailing him. Well, I don't see that he's been blackmailed at all, and I don't see that he's a victim. He's gone into this as a grown man, knowing exactly what's what and what's going on. But he has this privileged position, and he's a little bit on the simple-minded side, it might be, and he has some problems with women. Obviously, he's not very attractive to women, and so he has fallen into this, sleeping with having young girls that maybe help him to have a good sexual experience that might not be as easy for him. He's got a lot of problems. And he's just using, he's fallen into this to solve his personal problems rather than dealing with them or rather than being an honorable man. And this is of course connected with the whole idea that we have royal families who have all this privilege and all this money because they're born to it, which somehow represents the country that they are a part of. And every one of them is degenerate in many ways. It's all hidden away from the people. And then the people support all this because they like the fairy tale stories that make them feel good about, that they can feel connected to because these people are the royalty of their country and they act like they care about the people, and the people can sort of experience vicariously, that's it, can vicariously experience something of this royal lifestyle by reading about these people all the time. And the whole thing is just adding more illusion and bad habits to everybody involved. It's not anything to do with the nature and the natural way and the way we should be looking at ourselves and our lives. It's all sick. You know, it's very, very sick. So I'm going to, but before I go further into that, I want to talk about this Ghislaine Maxwell and her father. Now, her father was born with the name Jan Ludwig Hyman Binyamin Hoch. He was a Jew, and he was born in a town that was is now in the Ukraine, in Ukraine. But at that time, in 1923, in that time, it was a part of the Czechoslovak Republic, and he fought in the war. He rose from poverty to build an extensive publishing empire. He escaped Nazi occupation, joining the Czechoslovak army in exile in World War II. So that was in Britain. So he somehow got to Britain and he joined that, and he was fighting in the British army as a Czech, and he was decorated. After the war, he got to stay in Britain, and he built up a big, a major publishing house and other businesses, and became very wealthy. He had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 children, And this Ghislaine was the youngest. She was born in 1961. And she seemed to be kind of his favorite, his pet or something, because she was his youngest daughter, youngest child. And this man had a very flamboyant lifestyle, lived in Headington Hill Hall in Oxford, and he flew around in his helicopter and sailed in his luxury yacht and things like that. And he was said he was notably litigious and often embroiled in controversy, including about his support for Israel at the time of its 1948 Palestine War. So he was always pro-Israel and working at it outwardly, you know. And he was a big liver, and in 1989 he had to sell some of his successful businesses, including this big Pergamon press that he owned, his biggest one, most his well-known, to cover some of his debts. And in 1991, his body was discovered floating in the Atlantic Ocean after having fallen overboard from his yacht. He was buried in Israel. Now, his death by drowning is very questionable. It was whether he committed suicide or he was thrown overboard or it was an accident. Pretty hard to have an accident to fall over. I think it was in the morning, too, to fall overboard on your own yacht. But and Ghislaine was on the yacht at the time, and she was, rather traumatized by it all. But after his death, it was revealed that he had stolen hundreds of millions of pounds from his own company's pension funds, and that's why the talk went to that he had committed suicide, because there was no way to cover it up anymore. And his whole empire was collapsing, and his sons finally had to apply for bankruptcy protection, so they got saved. And, you know, another Bernie Madoff, really, is what comes to mind. You know, a guy who's a real good Jew, takes care of the Jews, takes care of Israel, and at the expense of, and is a crook, you know, at the expense of everybody else. Well, here's some more things about him. He was buried in Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. He's a great man to the Jews. And the then Prime Minister, after he died, British Prime Minister John Major said of him that he had received valuable insights into the situation in the Soviet Union during the attempted coup from this Maxwell. Of course, you know, he changed his name to something that was nothing even like his original name, Robert Maxwell, as so many of these Eastern European Jews do when they go to Britain. They get away with it. Nobody ever hears about their real name after that. And John Major called him a great character. And Neil Kinnock, who was then the Labour Party leader, spoke well of him, too, as a man with a zest for life who attracted controversy, envy, and loyalty in great measure throughout his rambunctious life. Now, you see how they put it? They want to praise this man, and they call all of his what ends up being criminal activity or unlawful activity as somehow, you know, part of his great zest for life and so on. And they go along with everything about him. This is a good example of the terrain that is created by these white elites who have benefited from rich Jews. Why they're satisfied to benefit from rich Jews, which doesn't benefit their people, is the question to be asked there. But they are. They are. They don't have the kind of chutzpah and the network, of course, that Jews have to accomplish things that these Jews accomplish. And they know it. They know they couldn't do it. So they hang on the coattails of these type of Jews and take what they can get and benefit to some degree just for their own selfish interests at the expense of all the rest of their people. Now, shortly, more about this guy and Israel, Maxwell and Israel. Shortly before his death, a former employee of Israel's Military Intelligence Directorate, Ari Ben Menashe, had approached a number of news organizations in Britain and the United States with the allegation that Maxwell and the Daily Mirror's foreign editor, Nicholas Davies, were both longtime agents for Mossad. And Ben Menashe also claimed that in 1986, Maxwell had told the Israeli embassy in London that Mordecai Vanunu had given information about Israel's nuclear capability to the Sunday Times, then to the Daily Mirror. Maxwell had something to do with the Daily Mirror. I think he owned part of it. And Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped by the Mossad and smuggled to Israel, convicted of treason, and imprisoned for 18 years. And he played a role in that, supposedly, possibly. Others have linked Shamir's, I guess Israel Shamir's, cryptic statement to Maxwell's having told the Israeli government that Mordecai Vanunu had leaked details of Israel's secret nuclear weapons program to Maxwell's Sunday Mirror. Yeah, see, they're calling it his. That's his newspaper for a while, the Sunday Mirror. Prompting them to kidnap Vanunu. So he played a role in that. He was working for Israel all the time, whether as, you don't have to be have some kind of a title as a Mossad agent. If you're working for Israel and you work with the Mossad and through the Mossad and so on, then you're working for the Mossad. That's just the way it would be said. He also... he was described as having contacts with Czech anti-Stalinist communist leaders in 1948, crucial to the Czech decision to arm Israel in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War that year. And also Jewish leaders expressed gratitude for Maxwell's intervention and material help in securing the freedom and immigration between 1988 and 1991. Of over 1 million Russian Jews through his friendship with Mikhail Gorbachev. So this was a very well-connected and influential man doing all this stuff while he was at the same time keeping his high lifestyle going by stealing from his pension funds and leaving his businesses bankrupt. So his daughter becomes friends with a girl, the girlfriend of this Jeffrey Epstein, who's in the center of this sex scandal, which he's absolutely, you know, he's been already convicted of it and got out in a short time, and he's still doing it. He was still, he's still going about it. And this is his daughter, and she's no better than he is. She had all these connections. Everybody liked her, it seems. She had all these connections high up in the UK. And so she was able to put a lot of things together for Jeffrey Epstein, and so they were a kind of a couple for a long time, and she functioned as a madam for him and a procurer of young girls. And this material that has come out now from Virginia Roberts, that was in the Daily Mail yesterday, the day before, where she states a lot from the suit that's been brought, a lot of that was revealed. So it's all very scummy. But I want to focus on the problem with Prince Andrew, really, because that's an example of someone who, let me find that. I'm jumping all around here. But the usual story that we hear and we're hearing, and you notice at the Daily Stormer, they're not talking about Andrew, Prince Andrew at all. They're just trying to make it all about Jews, all about Jews. And every white person is a victim. There's a comment there that I thought was very revealing, and it's by Franklin Reichardt. R-Y-C-K-A-E-R-T, who's always fusing royalty and high-ranking elites and so on, and in so many of these things. But here he writes on January 3rd at the Daily Stormer to one of these stories about this scandal that Jews rule the world by controlling the elites of the world by friendship, bribery, and blackmail. No form of blackmail is more effective than the possession of films of persons engaged in pedophile sex. There exists a worldwide pedophile network controlled by Jews for this purpose. Prince Andrew is only one of the many victims of this form of blackmail. Well, I got to stop right there because, as I said, this is the usual thing we hear, and this is what we're going to hear in the white nationalist circles, because they have this. There's a kind of an unspoken rule or law that you don't blame whites for anything. Everything you blame non-whites for it all, and all, whites are victims of everything. I don't think you know. I went along with that for a while, and going along to get along. And I'm not. I'm not trying to blame whites, but I would. The fact is, from what I said earlier, that this doesn't work. You know, this kind of approach doesn't work. It's been going on for a long time, and it doesn't work. We keep getting weaker. Why? Because we don't take the responsibility and recognize that we don't have to be victims. We don't have to be. We need to understand that we're not helpless victims. How is Andrew, Prince Andrew, in this whole story, a victim? He's only a victim of his own weakness, stupidity, and privilege. That's all. He thinks he can do things and it's going to be okay because Mommy Queen is going to make it all right. And he's got this private fortune, and he's got lots of, for his work that he does for the United Kingdom, the government. He doesn't get paid, but he has a generous expense account. He gets all his expenses, so he can fly around and travel around and go on skiing vacations and so on, and do a lot of things under the guise of serving the country, and therefore he gets away with everything. But it's not just someone like him, because any of us who want to think that we are victims of the Jews, I'm telling you, we don't have to be. It all depends on how you are able to control your own life and clean up your own life. Anyway, Franklin Reichardt goes on to write, and I think this is important too. He continues, "I suspect that nearly all elite persons of the Western world are such victims. Count on it that when Western politicians are invited for a free visit to Israel, that they will be seduced in their hotel room by minors, which will be filmed and then used for blackmail. A certain German politician has hinted that this is indeed the case. But of course, the Jews themselves like to use this form of sex also, hence the Dershowitzes of the world." Well, how many people are going to disagree with that? They're not. They're not going to disagree with it. Yeah, that's right. Wow, they victimize all of us. Well, you know, why didn't somebody blow the whistle on it if they were offered a minor girl in their hotel room while they were in Israel? You know, when you go to if you go to Israel as a congressman, you don't have to drink, you don't have to get drunk, you don't have to associate with in situations and parties and so on that you know are not right. You don't have to do that. You don't have to open yourself up to having photographs taken of you and used for blackmail. So I don't believe that. I don't believe that that goes on. If that happens to every one of them, then there's something wrong with them, that they're allowing themselves to be put in that position. Aren't they grown men? Aren't they people who are legislators of the greatest country, you know, the most powerful country in the world? What the heck is going on here? You see, this is an excuse that should not have any legs. And men use it for all the other men. You know, I don't want to be against men here, but the only person who's blowing the whistle here is this girl, Virginia. No, she's not a girl anymore. She's now 30 years old. And she seems to have a good husband. She's got three children. She's married. And her husband seems to be supportive of her in this. Or she couldn't be going on with it. But she is. She's determined. She's going to follow through. I hope she is. And that others will join her, as I guess a few have, maybe. So this is what it takes, because the men will all stand up for the men and say, this girl's probably lying. You know, they're all saying that already. We're going to see. It's going to be interesting to see how the white nationalist community deals with this, because there's no reason, in my mind, to make these excuses and say that this is that white people have no defenses against these Jews. Now, I skipped a bunch to get down to that Franklin Riker. Let's see, I want to, got only 8 more minutes in this hour, and I thought I'd play a little break music, although I forgot that never got around to picking it out. I'll just have to grab something for it. But, you know, Andrew got into trouble with this before, and this Jeffrey Epstein was put in prison for, he had to serve an 18-month term. And here's the thing. Here's another point of this. Not only was Andrew getting having some sexual, you know, going to parties and having pretty young underage girls flattering him and making him feel good, and he had sex at least one time with this Virginia, and she has said that he had no real appeal. He had no you know, grace about the whole thing. He was a loser. And so his wife, Sarah, his ex-wife, who he's still friends, they're still friends. Why wouldn't they be? They have two daughters. They together, you know, she's a loser. She was bad news too. And she got a £15,000 loan from this Jeffrey Epstein, and Andrew arranged it. Now, what kind of stupidity is that, to arrange a loan from this Jew who's supplying underage girls for your enjoyment and other people's enjoyment? And he's been to every, I think Andrew was to every one of this Epstein's houses and fancy. Here again, this is the exact formula. You have this, somehow this Epstein is a billionaire. I don't know how. They call him a banker. Haven't figured out yet how he actually became a billionaire. But he's a billionaire, and he's got all these homes and on island. He owns an island, and he has a home there, and, you know, a home in Florida, home in London, and other places maybe. Well, that's enough, I guess. They're all worth a lot of money. He's richer than Prince Andrew, who therefore likes having him as a friend. See, I don't think, they said, some politician said that Andrew didn't have any friends. He didn't have any cool either, because he was always opening his mouth and saying things that weren't too diplomatically correct or diplomatically careful. So everybody was down on him. Everybody is down on him, but because he's part of the royal family, nobody can do anything, and they have to keep protecting him. He's somebody who, if he wasn't, he would just find his own level of competence and live an ordinary life, and not be a problem. But because he's a part of a royal family, he is a constant problem. And how, in the history of royal families, how many of those have we had that have just done all kinds of damage and cost a fortune for the people and done so many terrible things, and they get protected? This is not natural. This is not a natural order for things to be in. So I can't find that, but it was that he was said, some British politician said that Andrew was an embarrassment in that he didn't have any friends, and therefore, you know, he was just looking for to be accepted somewhere or other. So let me just say that this is where we go wrong. We think that we need these people. We think that we uphold people we shouldn't be upholding, whether they be members of royal family or politicians or anything like that, any other kind of elite type person, and we don't want to take responsibility for our own lives. We feel like we need to stay within this system because we can't go outside of it. If you start out by learning that you can be in control of your own physical body by what you decide to eat and drink and not eat and drink, and then you don't need, you know what a freedom it is to know that the medical profession is not going to do any good for you. It's not going to do you any good. I know a lot of people think that's very irresponsible talk, but it's proven that modern medicine kills more people than it saves. It really does. But people are not given the information and are ignorant and think that this is where they're going to find the help. But if you learn what the facts of natural law are, and all you have to do, that it's like being saved, you know. It's like finding out that, gee, God is really there, and God really did, or whatever you want to call it, really did create things so that we couldn't be harmed, and we could take care of ourselves, and we could remain healthy, and we had everything for ourselves. We have everything in our body and everything in our environment to stay healthy and strong. And we don't need all these things that have been built up around us, which only cause us to be enslaved. And so the Jews are just a part of it, you know, one part of this. They're not all of it. But if we learn to have a healthy physical terrain, bodily terrain, and then from there start learning to have a healthy and being willing to discipline ourselves to have a healthy social terrain, we wouldn't have these problems. They wouldn't show up. As I said before, the bad things would disappear because they don't exist in a terrain like that. And the Jews would disappear. There's no way that we're going to drive them out. We can't do it that way. We have to set ourselves up so that there's nothing for them, that they can't exist in our environment. There's nothing for them there. They can't live in it. Huh? I think I've said enough, and so I'm going to go on to the next part of my program after I play a little music here, and I think I'll play Deutschland über alles by Heino. That's almost 4 minutes, 3 minutes, 49 seconds, and it's a nice, powerful song, so let's listen to that tonight. I'll be back after this musical break. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on January 5th, 2015. And I just answered a phone call, and I was going to say a little bit more about some part that I had just found in, about the Epstein thing that I had not said. But let me see who's on the phone here. Maybe it's a number I should remember by now. Hi, caller.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Hattie.
I just phoned in so that I could listen. Blog Talk Radio doesn't work very well for me.
You said that before. Okay. If you want to say anything, then go ahead.
Yeah, they tell you that other people could call in, too, if they wanted to in that way. But it says that you press 1 if you want to tell the host that you want to talk.
Okay. All right, I'll put you on mute. Yeah, I came upon this thing here about Jeffrey Epstein's handyman and cleaner named Juan Alessi. And he said a bunch of things. And, you know, you wouldn't think that somebody who used to work for him would lie about it. He'd have no reason to. But since he's not working for him anymore, I guess, he said some things in court. Maybe he was brought into court to give testimony, and so he did. But he testified in some court records that when he was working there as the handyman and cleaner for Epstein, he set up massage tables for Andrew on a daily basis when Andrew was there. And he's speaking under oath to solicitors in 2009, so he was under oath. He said pictures of naked women were on display by the pool, while other witnesses described nude photographs of underage girls adorning a stairway. And Virginia Roberts has said, too, that when she first went to the London mansion, when she walked up, this is the Florida mansion, because she lived in Florida. And she first went to that house. She was taken there by this Ghislaine Maxwell, the madam. And when she went up the stairway, she said there were photographs of nude girls, but she said she was so nervous she didn't pay attention to them or didn't really register with her or something. But she confirmed that was the case. So if you're in a place like that, you can't fool yourself to saying it's just an ordinary, you're just in an ordinary situation. And he also said that Miss Maxwell kept a laundry basket full of sex toys in a cupboard at the house, alongside a shiny black costume. And he said that the five-bedroom home was run like a hotel, with a host of celebrity guests passing through. Among them was Andrew, who stayed in the blue guest room, where there was apparently soap in the shape of male and female genitalia. So, and Princess Sarah stayed there sometimes, too. He called her Princess Sarah. He meaning the Duchess of York. You're obviously, if you're even going to the measure of having soap in the shape of male and female genitalia, you're just trying to inspire bring out sexual feelings in the people there. You're trying to make everything about sex, just get them all sexed up and get them comfortable with it. And it's all just so much fun, and we're just having fun. But for people dumb enough to fall for this, of course they think that they've been doing it for hundreds of years, too. They've been doing this, and they get away with it. And so much goes on far worse than this. I believe it. Far worse than this goes on without it, people getting in trouble. And all kinds of higher-ups are involved in it. And these are all white people who protect what's going on. They get something for it, I guess, but they don't care enough to have a healthy society. I don't think people know what a healthy society is anymore. And I'm not sure any of us do. We're going to have to find out again. It doesn't have to be a desert or a terrible place. It doesn't have to be a horrible, boring life. It would take some education and some learning and some remembering and some getting slowly freeing yourself from things that that people are used to doing. But anyway, what I want to say before I go on is that this is the only way. That the other way of somehow we're going to expose these Jews, expose what they're doing, it doesn't work because, you know, everybody, too many people are involved and too many people are doing it. And too many people are used to it and think there's nothing wrong with it. And people have been just absolutely corrupted. Corruption is just way beyond what we generally think of as corruption. This is just a moral corruption of most everybody, really. You know, most of us don't have any interest in stuff like that. But, you know, if you're at the right age, you're very vulnerable to it. So that I think is the only answer. I want to say that. I want to make that real clear, although I'll be talking about it more on other occasions. But it seems to me that this is what works for physical health. This is what the natural order has set up for our physical health. And most animals live according to that because they don't have any choice to do otherwise. They just have their instincts. And they eat what's right food for them, and they live how they do. And it's only pets, people who are animals. I mean, who are taken care of by humans, who start getting. It's a fact. It's an absolute fact that if any animal, every animal should be fed only raw meat, if they're a meat eater, only raw meat, and it's because we feed our pets cooked meat because people think raw is somehow poisonous or is going to, you know, have some bad bacteria in it or is not going to be good for them. And there's even theories that, oh, if you feed your dog raw meat, he'll get vicious. That's stupid, too. Totally untrue. But pets who are given cooked food are not become less healthy all the time. They become continually less healthy until they have to go to the vet and they have this and that and the other problem. Okay, I want to talk about Hitler and Nietzsche. I'm going to go to my email first, real quick. I probably don't have any emails about this program, but I thought I'd check it out. What am I trying to do here? Okay. Well, Frederick Tobin likes what I'm saying, naturally. Okay, well, here's Stuart says, the terrain, as you put it, is an important point. While there is much justifiable condemnation of the Jew, it seems often forgotten that it is the decaying white European leadership that allows the Jews to take root like a virulent disease to degrade and destroy society. And I think so, too. Centuries ago, the Jew couldn't get a foothold and was systematically expelled from one European country after another until the 19th century. However, as Goebbels pointed out in Communism with the Mask Off, the bourgeoisie, which replaced the old aristocracies of Europe, is incapable of fighting fighting off this threat. Rejecting Jewish culture may be fine for the informed minority, but causing a societal change of a majority and correcting the situation is highly unlikely until political power is won. We saw that the culture of the debauched Weimar society was not changed until the NS victory of 1933 could begin the cleansing. So the question which cannot be avoided is how to come to political power when the electoral process is totally corrupt and the shadows of political repression and economic depression is beginning to cast its ominous threat. What's quite sad is to see those who know the situation unwilling to organize a resistance. I speak of the Stormfronts, David Duke, Andrew Anglins, etc. It has a name, cowardice. Well, now here's where I don't agree with Stuart, because I know he thinks that you have to use militias and so on to gain political power. And I go back to what I was saying. It's not possible. we're never going to gain political power. It's absolutely unrealistic. The only thing we can do is clean up our terrain. And it takes, it's a slow process, one person at a time. Now, maybe this is impossible, too, because too many people benefit from what is there, and you'll never get enough people wanting to clean their clean up their terrain. But I would say that white nationalists are the ones that need to start doing it. It's white nationalists who need to see that this is what's necessary and at least do it for themselves and see how hard it is and see how they can do it. And that would make a, it would turn so many things around. It would turn the whole, if just 10 people absolutely did this, they would be talking about it and they would make, a lot of people would be listening to them. And it would make a big impression. I don't agree with Stuart there. So let's see what this other one is. I don't know if this is about tonight's program or not. So,
there you go.
Hey, it's you, Ray, right?
Yes, it is.
Yes, I said I should know your phone number, but I don't. I forget it. Well, I'm not surprised. I thought you might call.
Yeah. That was amazing coming out of the break after that wonderful song. When you clicked over, I thought you were talking to me because both of us hit at the same time and the other fellow started talking. I thought, oh my goodness, you know.
At that time I saw his number. I didn't see two of them, so you hadn't shown up on the screen yet, even though you
I enjoyed listening to the first half of the show, and I was thinking, as you said all that stuff, I just wanted to make a little comment. What you were describing there about victimization and being a victim, and you're saying, well, you know, sometimes we got to take responsibility and say it's not all, it can't be all the Jews' fault. And I was thinking of a parallel that to me is quite close to that, and that's narcotics and you know, you think about dope dealers and big money boys and everything, and then you think if there wasn't a market for the stuff, if people mm-hmm. say, hey, I'm not going to take this poison into my body, I don't want any part of it, then they wouldn't have anywhere, you know, to go with it, and your society would be healthier. So you say, who's the victim there? Is it the dope dealer who is, you know, he's pushing this stuff? There doesn't have to be a victim if they decide I'm not going to engage in dope taking or dealing with narcotics. And so, you know, I was thinking while thinking the health issue, you know, you described all this perfectly. You could have been talking about narcotics with
it's
your
all
comments.
The same, right.
Yeah, it is. And it reflects a weakness. And once people get hooked on the narcotics, then these dope dealers have them in their clutches. And it's very, very difficult, of course, to break away. And it's the same thing with the Jewish economic system. Once you're in their mm-hmm. economic system and locked in, it's very, very difficult to break out. You know, let's say a big construction company. And the Jew comes in and says, hey, I'll get you a couple of big contracts, big money-making contracts here, but I kind of want you to do things the way we want them done, and I want you to hire and fire the people we say you hire and fire. The big money looks real nice, and so they say, well, let me just take a couple of jobs for them. And before they know it, someone else is running their company. And so... to me, it was just quite a parallel to the narcotics business, and in fact, a lot of the same people are behind both. But it was very interesting to think about victimization, and you're quite right to say, "Hey, we got to take care of our own. We have to be responsible and say, I'm turning away from this stuff, and I can't take it anymore." But then you correctly brought out how very difficult that is in today's society. But anyway, I enjoyed it because it was thought-provoking, and I just thought I'd call in and say hello, and I wish you the best on the second half of the program. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, if you want to stay on the line and maybe join in a little bit, or if you want me to, if you want to hang up and just listen, it's up to you, Ray. Because I'm going to be talking about this Nietzsche thing now, and that has something to do with our table talk.
Sure. Well, I'm going to stay on the line and listen, because I'm listening on the line rather than on the computer, just like I do when we do our show.
Okay, so it work better for you, too, to do it that way?
Actually, I could hear you fine on my computer, but I thought, you know, I might want to offer a comment the opportunity presents itself. So I went ahead and dialed it on my phone, and so I'm listening on it. I have the computer turned down to no sound, so it doesn't give us some feedback or anything.
I can put you on mute, or if I can just leave you the way you are in case you want to say something. Well, what's been happening is why I got onto this thing about Hitler and Nietzsche is because there's been something of a back and forth on one of in the comments section on one of my posts, the one that says hundreds attend memorial mass for World War II Croatian leader in Zagreb. And on this, if you've looked, there's someone named Finn who's written comments before, and I thought they all worked out quite well. And he wrote and asked me to look at a video and give my opinion of it. So I looked at it and I gave my opinion of it and tried to be pleasant enough. But then I added a P.S. to it because I had forgotten to mention the part about Nietzsche. And in my P.S. I said Hitler did not admire Nietzsche, as it was pretty much stated on the video. He said on several occasions, Hitler did, that Nietzsche did not particularly appeal to him. He did not read him, yet so many Nietzsche fans tried to make out that Hitler got his philosophy from Nietzsche. Not so. Well, then he replied to that and was very diplomatic and friendly, but he ended up disagreeing about a couple of things, but mostly about Nietzsche, and said, as far as Nietzsche, like any fan of Nietzsche, I seek to overstate his presence in all things, and makes a smile sign. So he's just kind of saying that, you know, he may be overstating it. But he said, granted, Schopenhauer seemed to be Hitler's favorite philosopher. He did, in fact, read Nietzsche, according to Otto Dietrich. And he gives this quote from Otto Dietrich's book titled The Hitler I Knew, or maybe just Hitler I Knew, on page 23. And Dietrich said, "But from the works of Nietzsche, Hitler culled only the cult of personality and the doctrine of the Superman. He was not interested in other aspects of the philosopher's writings. Aside from Nietzsche, the only philosopher I ever heard Hitler mention was Schopenhauer." So he is saying here that he's not saying that Hitler was reading him, but that he took two ideas from him, which he said was the Superman and the cult of personality. He didn't say he took them, but he culled them. That is, he only paid attention to those two. Aside from that, he only mentioned Schopenhauer, he said. But he does say, aside from Nietzsche, the only philosopher I ever heard Hitler mention was Schopenhauer. So he is saying that Hitler mentioned Nietzsche. And then he had quoted Table Talk. He had quoted that in Table Talk, Hitler said something about, he said that Hitler put Nietzsche as one of three German greatest philosophers. So I only said to that I answered his first point, and his second, I answered two points of things that he brought up. I just stuck to my guns, and I said the fact that Hitler read some of Nietzsche. What I meant by when I said that Hitler didn't read Nietzsche, I meant that he didn't read him on a regular basis. He wasn't interested in Nietzsche's ideas, where he was reading his stuff. He may have read him. I'm not saying he wouldn't have read him. I mean, I read Nietzsche, and I don't particularly care for Nietzsche, but I read Thus Spake Zarathustra back when I was about 22 years old. It depressed me, I remember that. but I was, it was a depressing summer when I read that, so I was reading it in depressing surroundings. So, you know, you can read something to find out what it is, but not particularly care for it. That's what I meant. And he didn't keep reading him like he continued to read Schopenhauer. And I don't think he read a lot of philosophy apart from Schopenhauer. And so I said, you know, I said that. And I said I've read things by Hitler. I don't know where now, but saying that he didn't particularly care for Nietzsche. He wasn't. But Otto Dietrich said what he said, that his efforts to link Nietzsche and Hitler, back of trying too hard and twisting the truth, I guess this hurt his feelings, in order to create a Hitler in your own image, I said. So that's that. And then he came back again. And he's come back more that I haven't posted, but he came back again. Said that as far as Nietzsche, I said in the video, it's personal opinion. It's really impossible to figure out how much, if at all, was influenced. You had just said he did not read him. Well, I thought I had explained in my previous comment back to him that when I said he didn't read him, I didn't mean he had never read it, but he just wasn't something that he read with the kind of interest that he had for Schopenhauer, and didn't continue to read him. But he's making a big deal out of the fact that just wants to make a big deal out of the fact that I said Hitler didn't read Nietzsche. And he says, I wanted to show you he did. And I said that Hitler did not admire Nietzsche, but he wanted to point out that he placed him among the three great German minds when he could have placed other names there. Then that was okay. You know, he made his points. Well, then I guess I said some last words. I said, as far as Nietzsche, as I said, I objected to his saying that Hitler placed Nietzsche among the three German great, the three great German minds, when he could have placed someone else. Well, so going to that particular passage, now this is telling, too, that in table talk, that is the only mention of Nietzsche's name. As he said, it was on page 89, I think it is. What Hitler actually said, and he's just having dinner conversation here. He had said, in our part of the world, the Jews would have immediately eliminated Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Kant. If the Bolsheviks had dominion over us for 200 years, what works of our past would be handed on to posterity? Our great men would fall into oblivion, or else they'd be presented for future generations as criminals and bandits. So that's the whole, and there's even more context to this. But this is the whole thing that where this fit in. So he's just saying, and I can even read more of it from that. He's talking about Christianity, and guess what? At this time when he mentioned Nietzsche, it was October 25th, 1941. It was all the way back to October 41. Oh, I forgot to say. And the guests, the special guests, were Heinrich Himmler and Reinhard Heydrich. The guests that he has causes certain conversation to take place. And he often talks about Christianity and criticizes it when Himmler is there. He says, so he's talking about that. And then he's talking about the papacy and the spiritual, and how the great explorations that took advantage of the spiritual riches of Central America. And from that, mentioning Central America and Rome earlier, he says, in our parts of the world, meaning Germany, Central Europe, the Jews would have immediately eliminated Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Kant. If the Bolsheviks had dominion over us for 200 years, In our parts of the world, you know, the Jews would have immediately eliminated Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Kant. If the Bolsheviks had dominion over us for 200 years, what works of our past would be handed on to posterity? Our great men would fall into oblivion, or else they'd be presented to future generations as criminals and bandits. And then he said, I don't believe at all in the truth of certain mental pictures that many people have of Roman emperors. I'm sure that Nero didn't set fire to Rome. It was the Christian Bolsheviks who did that, just as the Commune set fire to Paris in 1871, and the Communists set fire to the Reichstag in 1932. Well, he was wrong about the Communists setting fire to the Reichstag, at least so they've decided, but he believed that. He stuck to that. He wanted to believe that. The other is probably true. But he doesn't say anything more about Nietzsche. Nietzsche was just mentioned in passing because he is considered, probably by Hitler realized in the world, as the three major philosophers that people are aware of and admire, German philosophers, that would be Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Kant, or put in a different order if you want. But that doesn't mean, though, that he had any great feeling for Nietzsche. But a lot of people do, and let me go through a few things here that disagree with, cause a disagreement with that. Many Germans discovered Nietzsche's appeal for greater heroic individualism, this is something I read today, and personality development, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Well, you know, greater heroic individualism was not a part of Hitler's view. That was Nietzsche's view. And see, because Finn is trying to argue that Nietzsche and the Hitler's views were so close together that he must have some connection with Nietzsche because he must have taken some ideas from him because their views were so close. Well, they actually weren't, except as Dietrich said, he thought that there were superior people and lesser people. He did think that, and that's true. It's only true, but it's not any great insight. But he didn't go for the individualism because he thought that we should all serve the state. We should all serve the folk. Also, Nietzsche had no interest at all in the folk. Nietzsche was an opponent of Volkist Pan-Germanism and advocated a nobiliary, transnational, pan-Europeanism incorporating the cultural, spiritual elite from all Western nations, including Judea or Israel. Finn argues, doesn't like me saying that Nietzsche was Philo-Semitic, but I think he was. And he was so against anti-Semitism that it has to be seen as Philo-Semitism. If you hate anti-Semitism to that degree, I've got something here that he wrote about that. But Hitler was not a pan-European in that sense, and he wasn't an opponent of pan-Germanism. He was a pan-Germanist. He was a pan-Germanic. And, of course, understood that Europe was our homeland of all white people. He understood that and supported that. But he would never have accepted Jews or Israel into the mix as Nietzsche does. And those who are white nationalists and promote Nietzsche seem to want to ignore this fact about Nietzsche. Also, I was going to bring up that Hitler didn't describe Nietzsche or his philosophy anywhere except in that one mention in Table Talk, which is just didn't mean anything. And also, nowhere in Mein Kampf does Hitler even mention Nietzsche or Nietzschean terms such as Superman or super race. Of course, Hitler did think the Aryans represented a superior race to the Jews, but never in Nietzschean terms. And also, Joseph Arthur de Gobineau invented the theory of the superior Aryan race in the 1800s in his book, An Essay on the Equality of the Human Races. So it didn't start with Nietzsche. It started with Gobineau. And Gobineau believed that racial mixture would bring about the decline of superior peoples. Gobineau influenced Richard Wagner, who was beloved by Hitler, and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, whom Hitler read and met and thought highly of, and both of who influenced early National Socialism, Wagner and Chamberlain. And both were mentioned in Mein Kampf, but not Nietzsche. Perhaps the most notorious misrepresentation of connecting Hitler and Nietzsche came from a photo op of Hitler visiting the Nietzsche archive. Many have incorrectly believed that Hitler visited the archive on his own volition. Not so. The photo op idea came from Nietzsche's sister, Elizabeth Forster, a wealthy Nazi supporter who established the Nietzsche Archive in 1933. Well, the thing was, when Elizabeth Nietzsche married Mr. Forster, can't think of his first name, but he was a very strong anti-Semite, and they went to South America and tried to set up a community based on that, and it didn't work out too well. And they came back, but Nietzsche wrote to his sister, and I have that letter somewhere now. Where am I going to find that letter? Here it is. In December 1887, Nietzsche wrote this letter to his sister, who was at that time married to Mr. Forster, who went by the name of Elizabeth Forster Nietzsche. He wrote, "In the meantime, I've seen proof, black on white," he says, that Herr Dr. Forster, it's really pronounced Forster, "has not yet served in his connection with the anti-Semitic, no, excuse me, has not yet severed his connection with the anti-Semitic movement. Since then, I've had difficulty coming up with any of the tenderness and protectiveness I've so long felt toward you. The separation between us is thereby decided in really the most absurd way. Have you grasped nothing of the reason why I am in the world? Now it has gone so far that I have to defend myself hand and foot against people who confuse me with these anti-Semitic canaille. After my own sister, my former sister," he says, "and after Wiedemann, more recently, have given the impetus to this most dire of all confusions. After I read the name Zarathustra in the anti-Semitic correspondence, my forbearance came to an end. I am now in a position of emergency defense against your spouse's party. These accursed anti-Semite deformities shall not sully my idea." See? But in 1930, this sister, he was dead by then. Nietzsche was dead. And his sister was a known German nationalist and anti-Semite and became a supporter of the Nazi Party. After Hitler came to power in 1933, the Nietzsche Archive received financial support and publicity from the government, in return for which Förster Nietzsche bestowed her brother's considerable prestige on the regime. Förster Nietzsche's funeral in 1935 was attended by Hitler and several high-ranking Nazi officials. And Finn was trying to make out that, kind of suggesting in his video that, I think it was there, he even said it in one of his comments, that Hitler putting so much attention on Nietzsche's sister meant that that he had all this high regard for Nietzsche. But he didn't, but he knew that Nietzsche was world famous and was highly regarded, and that was good for Germany. And then his friendship with Nietzsche's sister and her fact that she was considered herself a national socialist and a supporter was good for his government and his party and so on. So all of these things come into play here, and it has nothing to do with Hitler feeling that he was really sympathetic to Nietzsche's views. This thing between Finn and I is too bad. We were sort of on good terms, and now it's deteriorated into, he wrote a last comment that was very critical of me, personally even, and then I didn't post it, and then he wrote a last one saying, "Now you're censoring things, you know," and he was even nastier to me, that I have a petty ego that gets bruised and don't even know what I'm talking about. Well, I have to say that during the end of his, he accused me of not paying attention to the end of his video where he said it was personal opinion. Well, I want to quote what he wrote, what he said at the last, what he calls 2 minutes of his video. He said this, I wrote it all down. "As to the philosophers Hitler spoke about the most, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche." Okay, let me say this right. "As to the philosophers Hitler spoke about the most, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, he apparently was very fond of Schopenhauer, as well as his relationship with the Nietzsche family and many of his concepts and his beliefs of Nietzsche. Now, you see, that doesn't make much sense. He's hemming and hawing around there by saying, well, there's no question about Schopenhauer, but he puts it, well, as well as his relationship with the Nietzsche family and many of his concepts and his beliefs of Nietzsche. That doesn't say anything. That doesn't go anywhere. Many of his concepts and his beliefs about Nietzsche, what? What about it? No, he doesn't say anything. And then he goes on to not only a Hitler fan of Nietzsche, but Mussolini as well, by which he means not only, he means to say, not only was Hitler a fan of Nietzsche, not only was Hitler a fan of Nietzsche, but Mussolini was too. But he doesn't say that right. And then he says, as Hitler in 1944 gave him for his birthday a very expensive edition of Nietzsche's collected works. Well, see, that now he's saying that somehow it means something that Hitler gave a birthday present to Mussolini of Nietzsche's collected works, because it's known that Mussolini was a big fan of Nietzsche. And, Mussolini gave some incredible birthday presents to Hitler. So I guess Hitler was probably racking his brain to think what he could give to Mussolini that would, you know, at least, if not measure up, be nice enough gift. So he came up with this, because Mussolini once had given Hitler the famous Greek statue, the discus thrower, from one of the museums in Rome. And it went to a museum in Germany. That, and I think in Munich, that's quite an incredible gift, right? But Finn, or the narrator of this video, went on to say, but anyway, as you see, the criticisms of Christianity, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, you see the same kind of criticisms with Hitler and Christianity. For example, the earlier quoted from Table Talks, when Hitler spoke of, about that Christianity cultivated human failure hand in hand with Nietzsche's outlook of Christianity, rewarding the mediocre and penalizing the extraordinary. So in conclusion, and he goes on with his concluding remarks about the entire video, but mostly about Christianity, but you know, it's he's not saying anything here. You know, he's putting words together, but he can't really say anything about Hitler and Nietzsche, because Hitler never said anything about Nietzsche except that one mention in Table Talks, which I've already explained was not about anything. Now I'm going to go over a little bit to, and I want to say I'm sorry that things have come to this pass with Finn and I, but I have to say that I thought Finn was Finnish, and I've discovered now that he is obviously the narrator of that video, and he's an American guy, and he's using he uses an email address for writing comments to me that doesn't exist. And that's so common, though. So many people do that. They don't want to even give an email address that anybody can trace them. But yet he does acknowledge that he's the person who made this video. So that's who it is. And I don't have any hard feelings toward him. But I will stand up for the fact when people misrepresent things about Hitler that I feel I'm pretty clear about, and I'll stand up for my own opinion about it. I'm not going to just say, okay, that's just great what you did there, because, I didn't really pay too much attention to what he said about Nietzsche. I didn't watch it all that carefully the first time. I did finally take a closer look at it, and then I was even more in disagreement with him than if I hadn't have taken a closer look. And many people would just take that business about Hitler and Nietzsche and say, yeah, Hitler was a follower of Nietzsche. And it's not true. I'll say again and again, it's not true. And there's no evidence been brought forth here that can be used to say so, except that one little comment from Otto Dietrich, which doesn't confirm such a thing. So, and now I'm going to go to a nice email that I received on January 2nd, which is a kind of an apology, and sort of fits in here with this, because this person who was a member of the CODO revisionist forum and I've been on there a few times myself, but not for quite a while now. And he wrote to me, came out of the blue. He used the name Lohengrin on Kodo, and he said, "Dear Carolyn, after some years, I feel I owe you an apology now about a matter you probably don't remember." He's not an American. I think he's Dutch, so some of his English here is not exactly right. I'll try to correct it as I go along. But as a revisionist from Holland, I thought myself at the time, that is a matter of some time ago. I don't know that he doesn't give the exact time of it. He might not remember, but it's sometime in the past, at least more than a couple of years ago, I'm sure. I mean, longer than that ago. I thought at the time obliged to correct you about senseless cruelties committed by German troops in occupied territories against innocent civilians. I did so at the Kodo revisionist site under my nickname Lohengrin. The case was that you insisted that the Germans did not, or relatively few did, mistreated civilians. The Germans did not mistreat civilians in those countries in Holland, except if they were directly, or maybe Western Europe, except if they were directly fighting against the Germans. I agreed with you on that, but for the sake of objectivity, I considered it necessary to mention an incident that took place 2 days after the official surrender of the German troops in Holland on May 7, 1945, when members of the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, stationed in Amsterdam on the central square, opened fire whereby 19 Dutch civilians were killed and 119 wounded. More than 60 years long, or 60 years later, he means, this tragic incident was ever since presented here in Holland by the Netherlands, by press, media, schools, etc., as a typical example of German vileness. We know the Dutch love to present German vileness as much as possible. And he says, so it was burnt in the minds of the people of the Netherlands, including my own mind. However, recently I read some objective historical reports about that tragic incident, and it cleared my mind completely. The fact was, he says, that the Canadian authorities who were in charge in Holland after the German surrender, remember this took place on the 7th, May 7th, or at the time of the surrender, that the Canadians were in charge, and they had ordered that the Dutch civil forces, which were called BS or Binnenlandse, were not allowed to carry arms before the German army was disarmed by the Canadian troops. The Canadians and the Germans had agreed to this, that the Dutch were not to be able to carry arms because this was between the Canadians who were in charge and the Germans who were going to be disarmed. And well, what happened, Lohengrin says, was that many of the Dutch civil forces took up arms on the 6th of May and tried to disarm on their own account the German soldiers in Amsterdam. They started shooting the German soldiers and killed a few of them. They attacked on the central square, the building of the German Kriegsmarine. Well, when this happened, the Germans fired back, with the result several civilians who were on the square to celebrate the liberation were shot in the crossfire, and many others were killed and wounded in the panic that broke out. So you see a total different story than was told in Holland during the last 60 years, he says. See how this, I hope you got this. You know, it was the Dutch civil forces who were in the wrong, who were doing the wrong thing, the thing they had been told not to do. Maybe they didn't understand or whatever the reason was. But they were firing at the Germans and attacking the Germans to take control of them. And so the Germans knew what the Canadians had said, and the Germans were supposed to be surrendered to the Canadians and disarmed by them. So they were defending themselves. And so some Dutch civilians were killed. And so what do? Just like they always do. They blame the whole thing on the Germans. And so the Germans went crazy. At the end, they were so angry, whatever, and they started shooting civilians because they lost the war. Not a thing like that never happened. And so Lohengrin says, because you reacted at the time somewhat negative and averse against my then opinion that the Germans sometimes committed cruelty against civilian people, I feel you deserve in this case an apology of mine for being too fast with my correction on your objection against German cruelty, in quotes. Wish you success with your good work and a good and happy new year, Lohengrin. Now, wasn't that nice for him after all this time that he learned about that, I guess, just recently, and he remembered that between us, and he thought it worth, he took the time to write to me and tell me this. And I'm very glad to hear it because it confirms to me that my insistence that I've always had, even if I didn't know, I hadn't researched the facts of the case, that Germans just do not do things like that. Germans do not act out of revenge like that. Well, unless it's calculated, it's careful, it's planned out, you know, reprisals. But they don't turn bestial. They don't turn bloodthirsty. They're always being presented as doing that by the Allies. And here's one case where it's been somehow come out. I'm gonna have to look into this further. But it's come out that, thank goodness, that this was a libel all these years, 60 years against these Germans in Amsterdam. Now, the last thing I'm going to mention tonight is the David Duke interview by somebody named Michael Smirkonish on CNN just recently. Unfortunately, David Duke made the statement that he was kind of pushed into it, but he did it, that he believed in the Holocaust. It was a ridiculous exchange that was going on, and this guy was insisting on him saying whether does he believe in the Holocaust. David Duke, wanting to come across all the time as trying to reach the mainstream a little bit, he finally got a little frustrated and said, "I believe in the quote Holocaust." So he didn't say it quite. He didn't say it too well, but he did kind of say it. You know, he did say it. So, and I just wanted to say that. Well, wait a minute. I'm not done yet. He started out. Before he said that, he was asked the question, and he starts out, "Of course, I believe there were terrible atrocities." Okay. And then the guy objected, "I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear you say about you if you believe in the Holocaust." Then David said, okay, I don't care what you call it, but the point I make, okay, I believe in the quote-unquote whole Holocaust. But let me tell you something. Why is it that there's no movies, very little attention to the greatest Holocaust in the history of the world, which was the Holocaust of Christians by the Soviet communism? And he goes on a little bit about that, as long as he was allowed to, because it was that they were trying to end the interview. But, you know, I think it's just as bad. He started out thinking he could say, "Of course I believe there were terrible atrocities." Well, what I want to say is that no revisionist, I think, should ever say that, but a lot of them do. And he's not even a revisionist, and he doesn't know that much about it. But they all feel that somehow there must have been terrible atrocities by the Germans. I would never, ever, I don't think anybody should ever say that, because it really isn't true. It isn't true that, that 90% of the terrible atrocities were committed by the Allies. Maybe you can say that. Say, well, what I believe is that 90% of the terrible atrocities were committed by the Allies. Now, that's true. And then you can get on that subject. But when you start out by saying, "Oh, there were terrible atrocities," you've already given up, because if there were terrible atrocities, then there was probably a Holocaust too. And he did get stuck with that, and he didn't have to say that there was a Holocaust. And you know, I fault some. I was just talking about Cotto, but some people at Cotto and some revisionists who are afraid to completely exculpate the National Socialists for political reasons. They don't like National Socialism, and so they don't want to be rehabilitating it or accused of doing so or whatever, and they don't want National Socialism to come in vogue, which I can't see how it would, but they are liberals, and they are Jew-friendly, or likely Jews in our society. So they don't want to say there was no Holocaust, because the Holocaust is useful to them too. Just like it's useful to the real liberals and a lot of other people. So, well, David Duke I don't know if he's ever said he was a National Socialist back in his younger days, but he certainly is not now. And he's like so many Southerners. He's mostly, well, I don't even know if he says that anymore, but most Southerners are more anti-black and anti-Mexican and Islamic and so on, and they don't get into the Jewish issue that much. That's just the difference. You can't blame them for that. They're not going to stand up for National Socialism. But everybody should stand up against the Holocaust, and everybody should be careful not to say, I believe there were terrible atrocities. That's a mistake. And maybe I'll go into that more on another time. So now I'm going to close this program, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you for listening, and I invite you to come back next week. Same time, same station. This is Carolyn Yeager for the Heretics Hour. Good night.